Can you make decisions while you're meditating? Thank you for asking that question. It's very helpful. Yes, you can make sort of decisions or talk to yourself when you're meditating to guide yourself, but don't do it too much. And especially the deeper you go, the less you should do that. What we mean over here is that you can, at the beginning of the meditation, say you want to watch the breath, you can actually tell yourself, okay, come on mind, let's watch the breath and focus on the breath. But just give yourself a quick instruction and don't go talking to yourself all the time. Imagine that from here you had to go to Suvarnabhumi Airport to catch a plane to go somewhere. So you've got a taxi waiting for you outside here. And then you get in that taxi and you say, look, I want to go to the airport. Now, not Don Mueang, Suvarnabhumi. Now, I don't want you to rush because I'm a Buddhist, and be compassionate. If somebody wants to come in, please let them go in because I'm not in too much of a rush. And please turn off that radio and don't talk to me because I've just been meditating. I want to be peaceful and quiet. And I don't understand Thai anyway, so don't talk to me and don't do too fast. And because I'm very sensitive, I've just been meditating. Don't go up and down in the traffic too much. I don't want you to sort of go too fast either, because I don't like being dangerous drivers, and I don't want you to go too slow. Don't put on the brakes too quick because someone's in front, and don't sound the horn because, you know, I like peace and quiet. Now, already, if that's what you say to a taxi driver in Bangkok, they kick you out before you get out of the driveway. You're saying too much. The taxi driver will say, look, it's my taxi. I know how to get to the airport in my way. You tell you to go to the airport, you just sit down and shut up. That's all you need to do, and the taxi driver will get you there. This is the same what you do to your mind. You say, just watch the breath, please, and then shut up and let the mind do the job. The reason why sometimes we don't get to the breath is we're always interrupting our poor mind, telling it what to do every second, changing the orders, not giving clear instructions in the first place, and no wonder our mind rebels. Look upon your mind like a worker. You may be a boss at work, and this is someone who works for you. If you're going to be a boss, you have to give your workers clear instructions so they know exactly what you want. And number two, give them time to complete those instructions. So tell the mind, look, I want to sort of be in the present moment. And then shut up and give your mind time to do that. It will take a while. Be patient. And if you trust your mind that way, your mind will often do what you want. But if you keep interrupting it, how come we're not in the present moment now? Come on. Get there. Don't do it this way. Maybe I should do it another way. Your poor mind doesn't have the time to complete the task. Has ever that happened to you at work? You're doing one thing, and your boss comes up and tells you to do something else. And how frustrating that is. So look upon your mind like someone who's working for you. You give instructions, but kind instructions. Don't interrupt too much. And when you get very deep in meditation, you don't have to give hardly any instructions at all. Just maybe just even a tiny thought, a nudge is all you need. Anything more than that will disturb everything. Deeper in meditation, the less you need of instructions. Or if you're thinking about work or family life, gee, leave all that alone. Because this is your holiday. You're free today. You're not at work. And your family, just know how hard it is looking after kids and husbands. Oh my goodness, I don't know why you chose a husband. So much difficulty and problems and troubles. But at least today you're free. This is your time. So you're not allowed to bring your shoes into this room. Don't bring your family into this room. Don't bring your work into this room. All that's outside. This is what I mean by present moment. Now you're free. And you deserve time for yourself. If you don't give yourself time for yourself, you can't, when you go out of here, look after your family properly. Nor can you work well. This is a time for you which you deserve. And if you give this time for yourself, give yourself these moments of peace, It's an investment in your family life and your work practice afterwards. You'll be a far better wife and mother and a far better person at work by forgetting about it for this time, putting it down and resting. So remember, you're only a part-time wife, a part-time mother. When they're there, look after them, give themselves everything. But don't carry them on your back every minute of the day. And that's really loving your family and loving yourself as well. Okay. It's like, you know, all my responsibilities, what are they now? I'm the abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery. I look after this huge nuns' monastery, 563 acres over in Perth. I've got this big city centre, Dhammaloka Buddhist Centre. You've got this huge internet site. I'm also spiritual advisor of the Buddhist Society of Victoria, that's over in Melbourne. Buddhist Society of South Australia, I'm the spiritual advisor of. Spiritual director of the Santee Forest Monastery just outside of Sydney. Also the patron of the monastery in Sydney, Bodhikusuma. I'm also the spiritual patron and basic teacher of the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, who were there yesterday at the talk. I'm also chairman of the Australia Sangha Association. I've got all these responsibilities. But you know, I left them all in Australia. I didn't put them in my bag when I came here. I am a part-time abbot. So I never take those duties with me when I go. It's a great way how you can be very successful in life. When you're there at the office, you're doing your business. When your kids are in front of you, you're a mother. When your husband is with you, you're a wife. When you're alone, you're you. There's another question over there, yeah? Yes, sir. Okay, why is it some people say that if you just get stillness, you'll never get insight, all you get is peace? It's because they've never experienced stillness. That's why they say such things. Because if you know what stillness is, you get huge amounts of insights there. For example, I've already mentioned about sort of the body disappearing. One of the basic satipatthanas is body awareness. Do you know what a body is like? No, you don't. Do you know what five senses are like? No, you don't. You know why? Because you've always had a body. You've always been in those five senses. The simile I will now use is a simile of the tadpole. A tadpole born in the water, swimming in the water, lives every minute of its day in the water. How can a tadpole know what water is? It thinks it knows what water is. But because water has always been around it, in it, it cannot know what water is. However, one day, the tadpole becomes a frog and jumps out of the water onto the dry land. Now it knows what water is. It's got a comparison. It's got perspective. How can you know what the body is when you've always had one? How can you know what seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching is when there's always been there for you? When you let go of this body and go into the realm of the mind, then you know what body is like. Now I'm going to read, this is deep Dharma now. How do you know what will is? Choice. How many of you decided to come here today? None of you. You had no choice but to come here today. It wasn't up to you. Will is a delusion. You ask any neuroscientist. There's actually a neuroscientist staying in my monastery right now from Canada. And she just gave me a whole list of articles, you know, in neuroscience, which proves that the will is a delusion. One of those articles, I wrote about it in my book, Mindfulness what's it called? Happiness through Meditation. Professor Benjamin Libet, L-I-B-E-T. He did this great experiment where he just get his students or whatever to do a simple thing like just flexing their wrist up and down whenever they wanted. But when they decided to flex their wrist with another hand, they'd press a button. When they saw their will appear, the choice to press, to move their hand, they pressed a little button. At the same time, they had these electrodes on their skull, which could actually record a movement in their brain called the readiness potential. Certain parts of the brain light up. The readiness potential would say when the brain was going about to start the action of flexing the wrist. And the button would show them when they were aware of the will to act. And the experiment was trying to find out which came first, the will or the readiness potential. And what was found out through many, many experiments was published and was a basic tenet of basic facts of modern neuroscience. The readiness potential comes first. The brain makes its decision, and then what we understand and perceive as will comes afterwards. We do not initiate the action. That's counterintuitive, but that's the facts of the matter. Now that really worries you. Because what I'm saying here is you are out of control. Some of you have known that for a long time. I'll just reaffirm it for you. We are so conditioned. But that won't make much sense to you until you've gone to that deep meditation where will stops. Where you're beyond choice. That's the state of second jhana. The state where the mind is so absolutely still, there is no movement at all. Just solid bliss. The body is gone, you can't hear anything, you can't make any decisions. You can't move. The potential to move is gone. You're being like a little tadpole who's now gone out of the lake of will and choice. Chedana in Thai is stopped, and now you know what will is, what Chedana is, and that's scary at first, but that only happens in those deep stillnesses of meditation. That is why only in those great stillnesses of meditation you get the really big insights. Only when the tadpole gets out of the pond does it realize what water is. That's why anyone who knows what the deep stillnesses are of the jhanas, you know, that is the place where insight is generated. Without those states, the insight is superficial. And that's why this meditation is what leads to Nibbana, enlightenment. That's how the Buddha became enlightened. This is the path to the end of all things. Da 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 da. Does that answer your question? Any other questions anyone has? Who knows what enlightenment is? Who can tell me what Nibbana is? If anyone tells you what Nibbana is, I'll give you a prize, a box of chocolates. How many of you are Buddhists? Okay. When you're a Buddhist, you're trying to get to enlightenment? How come you're trying to get somewhere where you don't know where it is? What is enlightenment? It's like getting on an aircraft and the pilot doesn't know where he's going. Isn't that what you're doing? But you don't know where you're going, if it's really nice to go there or not. Follow the Lord Buddha. But why?
Because
Yeah. But it's important because this is one of my problems. When I was a young man, obviously I was brought up as a Christian. And when I was at school, I went to see the chaplains. It was a good school. I came from a poor family. I got scholarships all the way. And I remember asking the chaplain at school, you know, what is actually God? You know, what are you supposed to believe in? And the chaplain said something like, well, God is the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and end of all things, transcendent, beyond words, ineffable, the ground of all being. That's what he said God was. You know, when I looked at what he said, it made no sense at all. What do you mean the Alpha and Omega? No, beyond words. You know, the ineffable. Or the sort of the ground, what is the ground of all being? You know, I know the ground of Thailand, you can touch it. What's the ground of all being? Well, it was just empty words to me. That's one of the reasons why I rejected Christianity, because no one could give me an idea which made sense of what God is. Then I became a Buddhist. Then I asked all these teachers, what's Nibbana? And they said, the Alpha and Omega, the ground of all being, the ineffable, beyond word, the transcendent. See, I've heard that before somewhere. But then when you get some of these great masters, they actually make it something you can understand. And the best description of Nibbana, which I've heard, and this is what I'm going to tell you now, it's a great description, because it not only gives it a solid meaning, but it also shows you how you get there. And it makes meditation make so much sense to you. When you understand how does meditation and Nibbana come together. And one of the great things about this story is everybody can understand it. You don't have to be some scholar or some sort of professor. It's a simple story, but very profound. And it's a story of the five children playing the wishing game. There was once five children, and they were playing a game called the wishing game, which goes like this. Each child had a wish, and the one who made the best wish would win the wishing game. So they asked the first child, if you had a wish, what would it be? And he said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for an ice cream, chocolate flavour, because it's a hot day and he liked ice creams. Fair enough. They asked the second girl, if you had a wish, what would it be? And she'd already heard the first kid. So she thought a bit longer, and she was very smart. She said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for an ice cream factory. Then I don't get one ice cream, I can get an ice cream for the rest of my life. Not just chocolate, I can have strawberry, vanilla, whatever I want. Obviously, she was ahead. And they asked the third girl, if you had a wish, what would it be? And she thought, and she was very smart, she said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for $1 billion. So with $1 billion, I'd buy my ice cream factory. And the next thing I'd buy my own video game store. She liked to play video games. But you know the trouble with kids playing video games? They can't find the time because they've got all this homework and they have to go to school. So she thought, after I bought my own video game store, I'd also buy my own school. When I buy my own school, I don't need to go there, and I can still give myself top grades. And then when I finish school, I can buy my own university and give myself a degree. $1 billion, you can probably do that and still have money left over. And I'm sure I'll have enough money left over afterwards to buy whatever else I want whenever I want it, because $1 billion is enough to last you your whole life. So it's a girl with a $1 billion wish. And it's two kids to go yet. How can you beat the $1 billion wish? And don't think $2 billion or $3 billion, because $1 billion or $2 billion, it's so much money you'll never spend anyway. It's the same, practically. You have the same buying power. So they ask the fourth boy, if you had a wish, what would it be? And this fourth kid got a wish which was better than the $1 billion wish. This kid was, again, very smart and said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for 3 wishes. That's a wish. My first wish, I'll have the ice cream factory. With my second wish, I'll have $1 billion US. And for my third wish, I'll have 3 more wishes. That way, I can go on forever. Beat that. So this fourth child had the infinity of wishes. How can you beat that? The last child did beat that. They won the wishing game. The fifth child said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes. I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes. And thereby they beat the infinity of wishes. The last child was the Buddha, describing enlightenment. Being so content, you don't want anything. The child before that was the mogul, the person with immense power, the prime ministers and the presidents. Any wish they can have whenever they want. The people with power. So which is the highest of those happinesses? The infinity of wishes? Or being so content you don't need wishes anymore? That's why Nibbana, enlightenment, is the end of craving. So by practicing this meditation of stopping all this wanting, letting things be, making peace with things, opening the door of your heart to every moment, making peace with things, not trying to get still in meditation, not trying to get rid of your sloth and torpor, your restlessness, letting go of the wanting, being so content in every moment. That's not only the path to deep meditation, that's practicing what enlightenment is like. The end of craving. Being so content, you don't need anything anymore. Do you understand? No, you don't. But anyway, that puts meditation in perspective. You know that when you want happiness, you're actually creating the causes for suffering. When you let go, you find that you have all the happiness you ever wanted. Yeah. Present moment awareness, yes? Okay, yes. It's a very good question, quite common. You're asking that when you start the present moment awareness, sometimes, you know, I was saying you have to establish enough present moment awareness and silence, otherwise you haven't got enough mindfulness to be able to watch the breath. And that's very true. I've found from experience, my own and teaching others, that if you go into the breath too quickly, without enough awareness, because you have to have subtle awareness and bright awareness, if you try and hold, keep the breath, you just can't watch it. It just disappears. You get thoughts coming up. Or if you really try hard, you can force the mind onto the breath. You can hold it with willpower, but you get really stressed out and tense, and after a while you can't do it anymore. There's no happiness at all in the meditation. It's just like another struggle. But the problem is, you're saying, present moment awareness, you don't know what you're supposed to be watching. At least with the breath, you've got an idea of what you're supposed to focus on. That's a great question, but it's important to learn what present moment awareness is, which is why I introduced the recognition first of all. Only when you recognize what this present moment actually is, as an experience, and you get familiar with it, then you can hang out there. And even though it might be easier for you just to go quickly onto the breath, it really is worth your while, worth your happiness, to find out what the present moment is. As an experience, as an object which you can focus on easily. And because you're a children of our modern times, a child of the modern times, who has lost awareness of the present moment, you're not alone in this. This is a common problem which people have, which sometimes really hurts me, to know that these days, that when I say be in the present moment, it's so alien to modern people, they find it hard to know what to focus on. When you were a kid, you could probably do that so easily. Every moment you were just there, you know, playing with your friends, having a nice meal with your parents or whatever it was. And somehow or other that awareness and that life in the now has been taken away from you. in the difficulties and the struggles of your life. And you've done well in your life, you've achieved a lot. But the sacrifice of being here and now. And now I'm going to get you back into that moment again. So you're like a child again, when you want to be. Just experiencing this moment, hanging out in the now. And when it's time to go to work, thank you, now I've got to do something else. But every so often, you can just stop and be where you are and not be going anywhere and rest. It's a tough one to do, but it's really worthwhile. When the past is gone, when the future is finished, it hasn't arrived yet, what's left? Get to putting yourself back into that experience. No past, no future. What's left? What is this thing? And after a while you get so accustomed to understanding and seeing this present moment that it becomes something you know very well. You become used to it, fluent with it. I don't know if you ever tried playing a piano the first time. You just can't do it. Just the fingers just don't move that way. But after a while it becomes second nature. And you can play things without thinking about it. When you learn about the present moment, you can hang out in the present moment so easily. It's a huge help and resource for your happiness and well-being and your health. Persist with it until you can know the present moment as well as you know the house in which you live. Know exactly where it is, what it is, and how you can be at peace there. Great question, thank you very much. Is there any other question before we... Might be good to take a 10-minute break, and then after the 10-minute break, we can come back and we can do another meditation, taking off into inner space. So, if you'd like to just to, if you want to go to the toilet or to take a drink, have a bit of a break, and then in 10 minutes we'll do another meditation. If anyone wants any books signed or questions answered, I'll be at the front again. Just before we start meditation, is there any more questions anyone has about the meditation they'd like to ask before we start again? Yes, thank you, because that gives me a chance to have a cup of tea as well. Yes. Introduce children to meditation. One of the best ways is by example. Because I know that many, especially mothers, they sit meditation and they find their children come and sit next to you. And they just want to be with mum. And if you're peaceful, they become peaceful. They actually almost like in harmony with your mind. That's a great way to get children to start meditation. They just sit there quietly. And sometimes your dog or your cat comes and sits with you as well. So the whole family's meditating. But there's been a lot of people in, certainly in Australia, but also in the United States and England, that are introducing meditation in schools. I just told a young man over there, and this is well known, I think last year in Wellington School, which is a big public school in England, a very famous conservative school, they started meditation classes, compulsory, in the high school. And the principal, because it was weird that a British public school had introduced meditation, they called it, I think, wellness classes, they got in all the newspapers. I've obviously interviewed the principal. He said, look, I'm doing this not because I'm a weirdo, because this gets better grades in examinations. Simply because you're teaching your kids how to focus, how to really pay attention and be mindful, how to be still, and the grades go up. The ability to learn improves. If we do it properly, I tell the kids who learn meditation in Perth, you can get your homework done quicker and you go out with your friends earlier. And if you're in college, you can actually get high grades and still go to the nightclubs. Win-win both ways. Because look, kids these days, I mean, they want to have fun, they want to go out and enjoy themselves. But, you know, the mothers, they say, well, you've got to get your grades, you've got to sort of do well at school. Imagine if you could do both. Wow, and meditation is the key. You're just learning how to be efficient. Remember when maybe you were at school, you're given an assignment, you have to read the book. How many times do you have to read the book before you understand what it says? You're wasting time. When you're very alert and mindful, read the book once, you can remember it. I'm not saying you've got a photographic memory, but because you're alert, and especially if you're silent, in other words, you're not thinking when you're reading the book, then all that information can go in. The brain is like a sponge. But if that sponge is already wet, it can't soak up much. If your brain is thinking, you can't listen. And that's also why a little bit of meditation, a little bit of silence, would improve your relationships with your partner, with your children, with your parents, with your clients. You're learning how to listen. Very few people listen. When someone is talking to you, inside your mind, you're talking back. Husband is saying something, here they go again. How many times do I have to listen to this? Gee, you're not listening, you're just assuming what they're going to say. And they do the same to you. If you're silent, in a moment, it's amazing how much you pick up. You know, sometimes people think that monks, especially meditating monks and nuns, have got psychic powers, that we can read your mind. You don't need to do that. All you need to do is to be silent and be aware. You pick up so much. You're communicating. I call that total listening. And that's so wonderful in relationships and also in business. When you're with a client or with a boss, be fully there in this moment, silent. You pick up so much of what your boss really means to say. You get competitive advantage. And your relationship starts to blossom. But how many times do people have problems in their marriages and they always say communication breakdown? It's all about communication. And just talking it through is not enough. Isn't that what people say, we've got to talk it through? No, listen it through. Too many people are talking, not enough people are listening. If you have a problem, listen it through, don't talk it through. If you understand what I mean, you have to do more listening on both sides. That's what happens when you learn how to meditate. You have a happy life. Can I answer the question, sort of? Any other question? Because I'm still drinking my tea. Okay, let's meditate. Oh, sorry, you've got a question, yeah? Hey, you had one. Okay, how do you practice forgiveness, especially when they're like a double murderer or like a child rapist? Part of my job, being a monk, being in many prisons, not serving time, but just helping other people. And I've met some really bad, so-called bad people. But all the time I've been in prisons, I've never met a criminal. Never once met a criminal. All I've ever met is people who have done crimes. Now, I'm not trying to be clever here. This is what I mean. When you talk about a criminal, you think that's all they are. When I say a person who's done a crime, they're much more than their crime. I've never met a rapist. I've met people who've done rapes. I've never met a murderer. I've met a human being who's murdered another. There are no such things as terrorists. There's people who do terrorist acts. This is important because the first stage of forgiveness is seeing the big picture. seeing more than that terrible act, that terrible crime or speech or whatever, which hurt and caused so much pain to so many people. See more than that. When you see more than that, you see there is something worth forgiving. When you see something worth forgiving, you find now it is possible to forgive. It's a strange thing that I don't know if anyone has ever hurt you really badly. And you find that they've got, say, a wife who really loves them. They've got kids who adore them. You think, how the heck can they love someone like that? They're bastards. They're terrible. Can't she see? It's amazing, even tyrants have people who love them and care for them. And what's happening here is that they see something in them worthy of love. When they've hurt us, all we see is the hurt and the pain. So we can't see the bigger picture. So this is actually how we forgive, to see something worth forgiving in the other person. And then why forgive? It's because until you forgive, you're always in prison. You can't be free until you forgive what someone did to you. I'm not saying that you forget or just tell them, okay, you just go and enjoy yourself. I mean that you don't take the pain on yourself anymore. There's a great story of these two Australian ex-soldiers who were in Singapore during the Second World War. They were captured there by the Japanese on the British surrender. They were interned in the POW camp, sent here to Thailand on that death railway. They managed to survive. Many, many years later, they had a reunion. And at their reunion, the conversation went something like this. One said to the other, have you forgiven those Japanese yet for what they did to us and our friends? And the one he was talking to said, how can you? How can you forgive the Japanese for what they did and how they tortured and killed our friends and how they treated us? Never can I forgive them for what they've done. What about you? And his friend said, look, I forgave them many years ago. That's why I'm not in the POW camp anymore, but you still are in that camp. It's a wonderful way of saying that until he forgave, he was still in the POW camp being hurt by those guards. Until you forgive, you're allowing that person to hurt you again and to stop your freedom. When it puts you that, put it that way, you forgive them to spite them, if you want to know what I mean. I'm not going to allow you to hurt me anymore. I'm not going to carry that around one more moment. It's gone. Then you're free. Now, how about forgiving yourself? How many of you have done bad things in your life? How many have done bad things? Put your hand up. See, I've got my hand up as well. Because you're human beings. You've always done mistakes and done stupid things. But until you can forgive yourself, you'll never be free from that guilt. In Buddhism, we don't have a concept of punishment. In a monastic code, the Vinaya, there's no punishments at all. All you do is, if you've made a mistake, you go up to another monk and say what you've done, finish. And that's it, okay. The way the Buddha said, if you confess, according to the, what's true, and resolve to make amends, then that's growth in Buddhism. So once there was this trainee monk in Australia, in the first tradition of Ajahn Chah. If you want to become a monk, you have to wear white first of all and keep 8 precepts. And after 1 year you can be a novice monk, and after another year as a novice monk you can become the full monk after 2 years of training. So we keep that in Australia as well. It's called like QC, you know, quality control. And there was this young man, he'd taken the 8 precepts, the first year of training as being a monk. And he came up to me one day, I was his abbot. He'd gone into the kitchen and made himself a sandwich in the afternoon. He'd broken his precepts, you know, you're not supposed to eat in the afternoon. So he came up feeling really guilty. He'd eaten in the afternoon. And I said, fine, you shouldn't do that, but you've confessed, that's enough, just don't do it again, off you go. And he said, no, look, that's not good enough. I do need some sort of penance or punishment. I said, we don't have punishments here. He said, look, I know my character. If you don't punish me, I'll do it again. And I don't want to do it again, but I need some deterrence. He wanted to be punished. So as it was, I had just been reading a book by Robert Hughes about the early history of Australia called The Fatal Shore. And I decided, I'd just been reading about, you know, the punishments they used to give to these early convicts in Australia, those floggings. And I thought, well, if you want a punishment, this is Australia, I'll give you a traditional punishment. I said, okay, I'll give you 50 strokes of the cat. And this Anagarika, he went as white as the clothes he was wearing. He thought, oh my God, Ajahn Brahm's going to whip me. He was really scared. And then I told him what in Buddhism 50 strokes of the cat mean. Because in our monastery we've got a cat. I said, find that cat and stroke it 50 times. And learn some compassion and kindness, you mean-spirited, you know, trainee. So that's what we mean by 50 strokes of the cat. If they're really bad, give them 100 strokes. One, two, three. Because the only reason why he couldn't forgive himself is because he wasn't kind enough and compassionate enough. So please be kind and compassionate to yourself. You can learn from your mistakes, but don't punish yourself. We all make mistakes. With kindness, compassion and understanding, say, okay, I made a mistake, I'll try not to do it again. And that's actually the way we actually grow. If you get punished, all you ever learn to do is not to get caught next time. To be more sneaky. That's what happens. Do you have like speed cameras in Thailand? Do you? You do have speed cameras. You know, in Singapore you can buy these little machines which actually can, they can pick up the radar before you actually get close to the speed cameras. I know it's illegal, but how many people have got one? Because this is what they do. They just, if it's a punishment, you just try and not get caught next time. You don't realise why you should not be speeding. We just try and find out in Australia. In Perth, they have the speed cameras in certain places. So we actually find out where those places are. And we always slow down before we get to the speed camera places. And speed up afterwards. Obviously that doesn't work, because punishment, all that ever does is make you be more smart so you don't get caught next time. Instead of realising why you should not be doing these things. So guilt. Please forgive yourself. Don't carry around the past. You can forgive others, forgive yourself, then you are free. Okay, thank you for that. Give me time to have a cup of tea.
Now we can meditate.
So, if you'd like to, whatever you'd like to do, if you want to stretch your legs a little bit, we've only been back 10 minutes, so it shouldn't be that stiff. And actually, somebody did ask me, and I might repeat this now, they asked me, can you lay down, meditate? Yes, you can lay down in meditation, but when you are laying down in meditation, don't lay down on your bed, where you usually go to sleep, otherwise you will go fast asleep. So especially if you've injured your back or you've got some other problem, then it's okay to meditate sort of lying down.